Good evening. My name is Clara Sanguinetti, and I'm a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. On behalf of Dickinson College and the Clark Forum, I would like to welcome you to tonight's program, Science for a Crowded Planet. The basic resources for human existence, such as clean air, pure water, and forests, are in fact exhaustible. The depletion of these basic resources is further intensified by the dramatic increase of the global population. This increasing pressure on resources is threatening our environment. Water shortages, soil exhaustion, loss of forest, air and water pollution are global challenges we face today. As the former director of the U.S. Geological Survey, Mark Myers, was one of the scientists responsible for overseeing federal responses to these challenges. Myers is an internationally recognized geologist. He's also a past president and board member of the Alaska Geological Society and an expert on North Slope sedimentary and petroleum geology. He received his doctorate degree in geology from the University of Alaska Fairbanks, specializing in sedimentology, clastic depositional environments, surface and subsurface sequence analysis, and sandstone petrography. He earned his Bachelor and Master of Science degrees in geology from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. At this time, I would like to remind you to please turn off all cell phones and electronic devices. Also, since this program is being taped and some of our audience members may be hearing impaired, please wait for a microphone to reach you before asking a question during the question and answer session at the end of the program. Now, please join me welcoming Mark Myers.
Well, thank you for that great introduction. It's wonderful to be here. Hopefully tonight I'll cover some key areas of the challenges we face both environmentally and from public policy and the role of science that science can play to help us understand these issues better and to deal with them pragmatically. I hope I'll use an example of our challenges with energy since it's been so much in the news and the president's policy, and rightly so. What are we going to do about energy in the future? How does energy and climate interface? How does energy and the environment interface? Then I'll look at some challenges in understanding and managing ecosystems. And then finally, looking at some integrated products and some opportunities and some success stories to not leave you too pessimistic at the end of this discussion. So in this, hopefully, well, let me ask you this. How many students do we have in scientific fields here? You guys want to raise your hands? How many do we have in public policy, environmental policy? How many do we have in business? How about economics? All right, so hopefully all of you will see yourself somewhere in this presentation and see some of the challenges, because it's certainly not my generation, but your generation that's going to have to ultimately solve some of these issues for us in our very challenged planet. So I think it's interesting as we look, as a geologist, I study natural processes, but fundamentally that first bullet, there, humans have become agents of environmental change on a massive way. You know, in 1999, we crossed over 6 billion people in this world. By 2050, we expect to have 9 billion. Huge population, huge use of the Earth's resources. But of the land surface, about 80% of it is now inhabited by people, by us. About 40% of that land is used for agriculture. Paul Crutzen in 2002 in Nature defined the term Anthropocene epoch. Now, geologists like to use terms to define the Earth's history, the basic terms, the Paleozoic, the Mesozoic, the Cenozoic, capped by major extinctions of species. So as we look in the future, as we look at epochs there, we typically have called the modern epoch the Holocene. The Anthropocene is an implication that because we have 6 billion going to 9 billion people, that our human existence on the surface is the largest modifier, physical modifier of that surface. And in fact, that we actually as a species are about 10 times an order of magnitude more effective at moving sediment than natural systems on the Earth's surface. And you think about that staggering thing is you think about natural processes that with enough people and with enough activity, we are actually modifying the surface at a much, much greater rate than all the natural processes combined. And that's quite a statement. Therefore, the term Anthropocene has been coined, and I think it is actually a very, very effective term. So one of the other great challenges is, as we talked about, that amount of the Earth's surface that's being used, and I'll later show you how much of the fresh water that's being used, how much of the Earth's energy resources are being used. The bottom line is we are reaching thresholds of tolerances of these ecosystems of available resources. And that creates another whole challenge on a global scale. How do we manage these resources effectively to both preserve the quality of life but to preserve the core ecosystem services provided by these natural systems? It's a monumental challenge that gets difficult and more difficult as population grows. And then I'll add the issue of climate change. If you think of climate change, there are multiple effects, but one is it changes the distribution of resources, of water, of temperature, of species. If you're already using ecosystems for ecosystem services near the thresholds and you start changing them, you create disequilibrium with population and our usages. So it creates a great challenge. That challenge is, again, that much greater because of the lack of resiliencies left in the natural systems because of how much those systems we are using. That's creating a bunch of the challenges. And finally, the threats to the Earth resources are exactly that, that we rely on these natural systems, and failure of these natural systems can be very catastrophic for us as a society and certainly for the other parts of the living natural system. So if we look at our Anthropocene so far, we've transformed about 40 to 50% of the ice-free land on the surface. We use 54% of the available fresh water on the globe. That's us using it. It's not the ecosystem and ecosystem services using it. That's us using over half the ability of the system. Now add another 3 billion people to that, or 2.5 billion people, and you can understand the concern. How do we maintain the basic ecosystems given our need and requirement for water use? And we talked about that the last bullet there, that we in fact do use, we are a major modifier of the Earth's surface. I'll say one challenge is USGS is responsible for the mapping, basic topographic mapping of the United States. Many of our topographic maps are entirely obsolete just due to the human modification of the surface. You think about all our wonderful topography that's been modified when we put a bridge or a quarry or a subdivision in or a mine in, and you multiply that by the scale of human activity the last 30 years, and our databases are badly out of date. This is a slide from NASA on the top and a cartoon at the bottom talking about our evolution and de-evolution. But if you look at, and this picture has been used many times, the Earth at night, and you can see the lights. You can see there are very few places on the globe where human activity isn't involved using energy and mass amounts of energy. It is a huge challenge to maintain that energy infrastructure and then to do so in an environmentally friendly way, even more difficult. You can see as we evolved, we became hunter-gatherers. We then developed agricultural techniques, and then we developed the Internet. I'm going to talk a bit about energy, because clearly the new president has identified energy as one of our great challenges, energy in an environmentally sustainable way. And what do we do about it? First of all, again, one of the great challenges for our country, strategically, internationally, is the global competition for existing energy resources. So national security, energy security is being recognized more and more as a key driver for us. It's also recognized in that global competition, global stability it needs to be maintained. And if energy resources aren't distributed in a way that allows that we also have a huge international instability problem. If you look again at population, expanding economies, heightened demand, much of the demand growth that is occurring in our country is serious, about 1% per year, or about, pretty much this year we'll see a decline in the next few years. But if you look historically over the last 50 years, it's about 1% a year, your constant growth, even with these dips for recessions and these rapid growth periods. In the developing world, the energy growth is much, much greater. And finally, no matter which sources we use, there are environmental consequences for the development, both in terms of the extraction of fossil fuels, but also in renewables. I'm going to talk a little about that. And then finally, the scale at which we need energy resources as it grows, our ability to switch to other sources is greatly challenged because there is no energy source that doesn't come with environmental consequences and issues. So those choices we make have to have a lot of challenges for us, both in availability and the challenges of environmental sustainability. To show the challenge here, you can see, you know, these are from the Energy Information Agency, but just fundamentally, if you look at our energy growth between 1980 and basically current time projected to 2030, you can see 80%. The projected rate of growth, the historical and the projected rates, about 80% of our energy being provided by fossil fuels. You can see the size of the pie growing as demand grows. You can see a significant growth in renewables and in nuclear energy, but percentage-wise, not much growth. That is one of the great challenges. The scale at growth of demand means that even with rapid deployment of alternative energies, we're still treading water with relatively to the percentage of usage. And just to the right, to remind you that our energy is not all used for the same purposes, that about 22% is residential, 18% commercial, 30% industrial, and 28% is transportation. And you can see then the growth, that even through periods of relative economic decline, the growth has been maintained average at an average of about 1% a year. So if you look at energy consumption by fuel for us then, you can see where the liquids being oil and natural gas liquids being the dominant form. You can see coal and natural gas being relatively tied for now, and nuclear, renewables, and a large part of those renewable portfolio being hydropower at the lower part. The challenge here is when you look at the growth potential in the future, and which sources do you see filling the gap? And for the U.S., you see natural gas. Overall, slightly increasing to going flat because of availability of supply, but you see coal as the dominant source of energy. So if you have a carbon policy, it's trying to lower carbon emissions. This is very, very problematic. Again, that the source of available energy is actually in and projected energy is coal. You can see a slight increase in nuclear. You can see an increase of non-hydro renewables. But fundamentally, we have a problem that to fill the gap to make this work, the bottom line assumption is it's going to be coal. And that creates a great challenge for us as a country. If you look at the world, it's not a lot different. The exception is you see worldwide natural gas going and increasing at a greater rate relative to coal, or at least at a rate sustaining equal to coal. So you don't see that flattening of natural gas. You see a roughly parallel path. And you see, again, hydro largely flat, nuclear growing slightly, but oil being the dominant growth source, just like in our country. So if we look at electrical generation, you know, I believe, you know, the changes in policy will lead to an increased use of electrical energy as a preferred source for transportation and for heating, for other sort and for general use. The challenge here is electricity has to be generated by an energy source. And so you're not really saving environmentally if your energy source is the same energy source as you would use for transportation otherwise. So if you're burning oil to create electricity, you're not fundamentally gaining from a pollution or environmental standard. So if you look at the United States historically on electrical generation from the 1970s, there was from 75 to 2004, again, you see the dominant increase in source have been two, an increase in nuclear and a very much a large increase in coal to generate electricity. So if we're going to generate electricity by other means, it means massive investment at a scale. And again, this is against a portfolio where not only do we have to increase the percentage, but we have to deal with the growth problem of population growth and usage. So there's a huge issue of how are we going to fill this in an environmentally friendly way. You also can see from the lower slide there just the amount of relative increase. And when you look at the world situation again, you see coal more flat and you see more natural gas worldwide because there are a lot of international supplies of natural gas that are coming online to serve European markets, potentially to serve India and China. So now you're the President of the United States, and you've got to decide on how you're going to maintain our energy independence to some degree. You've got hard decisions to make. If you see the bigger the dot, the larger the technically recoverable undiscovered resource estimate is. So what do the future resources look like based on our best technical knowledge? You can see the big circles, Alaska and the offshore and in the Rocky Mountain region. And you can see the difficulty the Secretary of Interior has when he decides on what is his policy going to be with the offshore, what is his policy going to be in the West with respect to energy development on oil, because that's where the future resources exist. Natural gas and oil look relatively similar. The big dots are primarily in the same areas. So those policy decisions that are being made in the near future have a great effect on where our future energy will come from. Look at coal reserves. Coal is spread out through much of the country, including Pennsylvania and the Appalachians. But when you look at where the most mining is going on, it has switched to dominantly to the western states like Wyoming, and a few of the southern states in Appalachia. But fundamentally, again, lots of coal resources, but the environmental choice is there. Are we going to use these resources? So what do we do? Alternatives to coal and oil, natural gas has a much lower carbon footprint. There are potential long-term sources like natural gas hydrates. Natural gas hydrates are basically natural gas or methane in a lattice of water molecules that's in a frozen condition, or it's basically an ice lattice. Natural gas hydrates occur at certain temperature pressure regimes, often in the offshore at relatively deep water and continental shelves, and then also in permafrost regions at depths of burial, basically at the base of permafrost. One of the advantages of natural gas hydrates is a hugely concentrated source of natural gas. Again, about, if you look at a cubic foot of natural gas hydrate, it equals 160 cubic feet of natural gas in its gaseous state. It's a hugely concentrated resource. It's also a very abundant resource that is yet to be harvested. And I'll go back there for a second. You can see in the red dots locations, some of these are very attractive. If you look offshore of India, if you look offshore of Taiwan and China and Japan, you will see significant known deposits of natural gas hydrates. So in areas that are relatively poor for energy, these hydrates exist. That's just to show with the United States, the in-place numbers, which are not what's recoverable, but what we estimate on the ground, far dwarf the recoverable resource base for all natural gas. So here's one resource, much lower carbon footprint, that could be available in the long term to help us out. USGS has spent a lot of time studying gas hydrates around the world, including assessment, coring of these hydrates, and in testing of these hydrates. And again, the initial results are very encouraging in certain conditions. So this is one possible very large source of energy that could help us bridge this problem if we put the research into it and we can invest in it. It is also, again, very strategic in areas of the world that are very resource poor and very dependent right now on coal. We jump to renewables. On the renewable front, many states have actually put in renewable portfolios, which is a very good thing. But you look at the pie, and again, this is 2005, that pie might have increased a little bit there with wind activity. But you can see that solar is a relatively small, biomass, largely ethanol, is a significant contributor. Hydro is the other significant contributor. Only 5% of our energy in that renewable portfolio is coming from geothermal. So there are some grid opportunities within this portfolio, again, with significant capital investment to help improve the mix of fuels we use. So geothermal energy, high temperature geothermal, the map on your left shows in red the higher temperature areas. There is a more potential for high temperature geothermal. Clearly in the western states, it's a product of the geology and the subduction zone off the Pacific coast. But you can see that for high temperature geothermal, in the graph up there in red, you see the actual production. California leads the country by far with geothermal. but the potential is an order of magnitude greater in high-temperature geothermal than we're using. So this is another source that has great opportunity for increase to potentially up to like 10% of our electrical generation needs. But it doesn't end with high-temperature geothermal. Traditionally, much of the geothermal was developed in the 70s at very high-temperature reservoirs. And for geothermal to work, you have to have temperature, you have to have a reservoir with fluids, and you have to have movability of those fluids and be able to take those fluids, pull them up to the surface, take the heat out, and put them back in a contained system. So you need certain geologic characteristics, high temperatures, traditionally. Now, we're learning now that we can use technologies at much lower temperatures through newer technology, so we don't need as high a temperature, which opens up a lot of the stuff to the east of that area in red you saw on the map. Secondly, we are learning now how to create artificial reservoirs. So instead of relying on having to have those reservoir properties, we can drill a well under the ground, fracture the rock, inject our own fluids in there, and start creating geothermal systems. So there's a way to manufacture and engineer low to moderate geothermal energy that could be highly constructed and would dramatically increase that beyond that tenfold potential increase. So here's a potential solution that has a lot of environmental preferred. It's a long-term solution. It takes a huge amount of upfront capital investment to build one of these plants. So it's clearly going to need help and subsidy, but it's one of the things I think on the future that might be a bright spot. Wind energy, if you look in the green dots, those are where the highest amount of wind energy is. You can see a dramatic increase. It's still a relatively small part of our portfolio. Challenges with wind are birds and bats tend to not like them very much. Surveys done a lot of work using radar surveys to see how much damage is occurring. Bats seem to be attractive to the turbines, so we have environmental sighting issues. And you can see a lot of the larger productive area of the winds are also in the major flyways for migratory waterfowl and other birds. So we have environmental issues, we have sighting issues, we have electrical grid issues. It's highly distributed and needs a much larger electrical grid. And you can see the new president has said one of our big challenges is to build that next generation electrical grid. That comes at environmental cost, though, bisecting land and habitat. Biomass, particularly corn-based ethanol, has just taken off, as we know. And I will say this is, in my mind, a very challenged resource to use. You can see the increase. You can see in the yellow dots along the Midwest, down through Nebraska, Oklahoma, down toward Texas, the large amount of corn-based ethanol that's coming into the system. Challenges with corn-based ethanol are it takes 4 or 5 gallons of water per gallon just to process it. The amount of water for irrigation is probably 20-fold that. Secondly, a lot of land has been taken out of carbon conservation status that was sequestering carbon was habitat. Now it's become corn, so we're actually probably negative with respect to carbon sequestration. We're actually putting a lot more carbon in the atmosphere. Thirdly, the amount of fertilizer and energy necessary to create the energy makes it a pretty inefficient way to generate energy. Fourthly, the cost comes at the replacement of corn that would normally be used for food stocks to be used for agriculture for generating energy, and that has had consequences, particularly in the third world, with respect to the cost of food. So, in some ways, very challenging. You saw that line of bright dots. This is a view of the groundwater aquifer system, the High Plains Aquifer, one of our great aquifers. The dark red are where we've dropped the water table down more than 150 feet. And the yellows between 50 and 150 feet. So you can see we have dramatically mined our groundwater system in non-sustainable fashion in order to produce ethanol. So it is greatly challenged with respect to water uses and water management in our country. Hydro, if you look at the graph on the hydro there, over time, this isn't percentage-wise, this is the amount of energy produced, it's basically flat to slightly declining. The United States, with the exception of Alaska, has really used up most of its hydro capacity. And many of those hydro projects are old, and some of them are being taken out of commission, actually for environmental purposes, for protecting salmon runs, for ecological purposes. So we're actually losing capacity with respect to hydro rather than gaining it as an energy source. So we have environmental challenges with respect to managing ecosystems, using water for those ecosystems, or maintaining the hydro systems. So we cannot expect in this country really to grow any significant amount of hydro because the good projects have already been done, and in fact we're losing capacity, and then percentage-wise hydro will play a less and lesser role in our country. So again, it's one of the tools that's basically going to be maintaining existing production at best. Then finally, if you look at the chart, if the goal here is to reduce greenhouse gases, one of the great challenges here is the fuel sources that we cited. Not only in the developed world, you can see in the light blue the percentage of emissions in 1973 that were from the developed world. 2004, 30 years later, the developing world pie is much bigger. And if you'd look at that pie in 2008 or 2009, it would be substantially bigger with the growth of industrial and coal capacity out of China and India. So just to point out, the problem is national, but it's also very, very much global. And we really need to find global energy solutions if we're going to deal with greenhouse gas emissions and challenges. All the projections show increases from existing levels. And pretty much no matter which scenario you use, EIA or IPCC, the questions are we going to sustain a lower level of increase rather than actually decrease greenhouse emissions unless we dramatically change these fuel sources? So hope it's not too pessimistic yet. Water, I'm just saying, again, I mentioned, I'll spend a little bit of time. Water is one of our most undervalued and limited resources on a global scale. It's simply a matter of not only population, but it's a matter of where that population is living. Increasingly, you look at our demographics, we have moved to the Southwest. Areas like Atlanta have grown dramatically, and we're finding we're having shortages of water. Some of those shortages are due to lack of capacity of the infrastructure. Others, like in the West, are truly due to limitations of capacity. Our water, and again, usage is fundamentally in three different categories. We use it for human consumption, we use it for agriculture, and we use it to preserve ecosystems and manage ecosystems. And so those three uses, you can imagine what are our priorities. That's putting a lot of stress on the natural ecosystems. Add climate change to the issue, and we're seeing with higher temperatures, particularly in western and high elevation areas, less snowpack, less recharge rate, less water overall recharging into the system. And we have fully allocated the water available on the surface and much of the groundwater system. So we are greatly challenged, particularly as areas like Phoenix, Las Vegas grow, how do we manage it? You know, we have treaty rights with other countries. We have ecological endangered species issues we have to honor. It's a huge area of conflict. And there are no easy answers with this question because it's not a matter of more effective storage in many of these areas of the West. It's a matter of limitations of actual capacity of water. So we're going to have to either ration it, be more conservative, limit growth, or limit agricultural use, which is still percentage-wise our largest use, our largest consumptive use of water. One of the challenges of water is it doesn't honor political boundaries. We have to manage waters on a basin-wide, not a political-wide jurisdiction. Our water laws and regulatory structure is set up jurisdictionally by county in some cases, by state in other cases, and by nation. Groundwater and surface water are regulated through entirely different processes, yet they're interrelated. This groundwater system survives only if it gets recharged from the surface water system. So we have to have a better way, a more holistic way to manage the entire water system. And we have to be able to do it over larger political entities than we currently do. Challenges biological side, equally great. You know that as human habitation continues, as climate change continues, we're seeing a significant loss of biodiversity. Oops. We're seeing, again, as we modify the landscape, increased flooding, increased landslides, increased turbidity in water systems, increased temperature of our water systems. And, again, we have experts in this room, I understand, on coral reefs, but we are definitely having issues with maintaining the viability of our coral reefs through ocean acidification, temperature rise. So great challenges on the biological resources that are integrated into these water and energy issues as well. So how do we deal with all this? First of all, our policies need to be based on good science. And the science has to acknowledge that our resources are interrelated, both on its, in the terms of political boundaries, but also in terms of geologic, biologic, air, and water, that we're looking at whole ecosystems. And then, again, population growth and climate change accelerate the complexity of managing these systems, particularly when we're at the near capacity of resiliency of these systems. So we're going to have to, in the future, if we want to sustain our societies, if we want to sustain the natural systems, manage them in a much more effective long-term way. And that's going to take a tremendous amount of scientific knowledge and basis. It's a great opportunity for our young scientists here and our policymakers. So this is a simple view. This is from the Guth on Earth observation showing the interrelationship of the natural systems. And the Earth is a complex system of systems. It's a great way to look at it. That no one discipline holds the knowledge base necessary to understand this, that all the disciplines have to be working together in a coherent fashion. And that in itself for scientists is very challenging. Some of the good news, a lot of work's going on at the large scale to create integrated monitoring networks. This is an example, again, from the Guth on Earth observation, where we're taking space-based systems, air-based systems, sea-based systems, land-based systems, in-situ monitoring at a local level, combining it through very sophisticated data management, data modeling, data integration to come out to help understand these core societal values and to managing these resources. I had the pleasure in November of being the U.S. lead at this group of Earth observation. We had 70 countries there working on commonality. And at the USGS, we manage the Landsat satellites, providing the basic mid-resolution data for the world. We determined to release the entire archive of data free of charge on the Internet. And that was over 2 million images, the largest data set, and it goes over a period of 35 years. That allowed you to get complete views at 30-meter resolution of the entire Earth's surface on a seasonal basis for that 35-year period. So we can really monitor Earth's system changes over that length of period, longest operational flying satellites in the world. And that data is now going to be free to everyone. We had a heck of a fight with the Office of Management and Budget to do it, but with the Secretary of Interior's blessing, we went and did it. Because we did that and announced it at the meeting, China said, our next satellite is going to be free. We're going to release our data. Japan is going to release some of its data. So now we're getting the countries of the world together to provide this data out there to any scientist or individual to download and to be able to use. Not only the current data, but what was interesting, when we released the data set, the most popular data came from the past history, trying to get a record of environmental change over a multi-decadal cycle to understand these changes and to help us to better model what the future might look like. The biggest downloaders, China, Africa, and universities. So it's pretty neat. The developing world is picking this data up, and we in the United States are leading the effort, but other countries are doing similar things. So this is a great organization, GEO, because it provides a positive one-upmanship, and the citizens of the world benefit from it. So this is a really neat effort that's going on that we hope continues in the next few years to develop even more and more data sets, to archive those data sets, to make them available, and to integrate the information. Scientific data in itself is not enough. We have to be able to deliver that information effectively to policymakers. Traditionally, scientists deliver that through traditional publication, journals, presentations like the one I'm making now, but it's not enough. The challenge will be, because these ecosystems are in disequilibrium, because change is occurring rapidly, because the change is not linear, because it's complex, we're going to have to model these future outcomes, because you can't target what the environment looks like today. You've got to target it 10, 20, 30 years in advance if you're going to make systematic policy changes to affect it. We can, again, if I look at the ethanol decision, that's one case where I would say we did not do a good job of doing that, understanding the environmental consequences, the energy transfer, and all the issues ahead of time. We cannot afford, without the resiliency, we have to understand the true trade-offs. which is going to mean we're going to have to model, not only understand the current conditions, but model future conditions. It's going to be very challenging. The early climate models that have been formed are not adequate. Those climate models have to be worked. They have to be backcast. They have to have a lot more actual monitoring data, and they have to be regionalized to localized to be of any value beyond general conceptual models. So a lot of work's going in the community to develop those sorts of models. My own contention is the models have to be probabilistically based, since a deterministic outcome 50 years from now is a fantasy, probably. So we will have to work and develop those models with transparency. We have to recognize, as we talked about at dinner tonight, the shortcomings and the inherent bias in the models, but we have to develop them. Communities of practice have to work together. Long-term databases, integrated information sets. Having Google Earth's not enough. We need authoritative databases that are trustworthy, integratable at a scale, and aren't apples to oranges. So a huge amount of work has to be done in developing cross-discipline standards of scale, standard definitions, standard data dictionaries, standard metadata, and then standard modeling, standard computer modeling to overlay that data in coherent fashions. It's a huge challenge, but a great challenge for scientists. Decision support tools. It's not enough to provide the data. We have to be able to put that data in a context that's useful to decision makers. And I'll talk a little bit about ecosystem services later. We have to be able to value the natural system delivery of service to us as well as the man-made or natural systems. Because right now we badly undervalue clean water from our resources. We probably undervalue energy in many ways. Just two examples. And we certainly undervalue the natural systems as protectors from disease, as from filters from pollutants, etc. And then finally, partnerships. There is no agency. USGS has 9,000 people. We are totally inadequate to do this sort of work. We have over 2,000 partnerships in a 9,000-person agency. Universities, federal agencies, agencies that, like the GS, that can put long-term records and maintain databases, need to be working with scientists on the ground all over the world. We need to form communities of practice across disciplines and across scales. This issue has to be international. We have to share data. So these partnerships become crucial. Partnerships take money. They take people's willingness to travel. They take individual commitment. And they take organizational commitment. Just a quick commercial for the USGS here is we based our 10-year plan about 2 years ago on this exact approach. And these are the key areas that we're looking at: understanding ecosystems, predicting ecosystem change, energy and minerals, natural hazards, risk and resiliency, environment and human health, wildlife and human health, water quality, water quantity and availability, climate change and variability, and finally the tools to fully integrate that information. So I mentioned the ecosystem, and just to give you an example of the components of the ecosystem, they start with the bedrock. That's great for the geologists. They go up to the groundwater, soils, the water surface, the landform surface, the biota, the climate, and every one of those pieces is critical and interrelated for us to do this. So that takes a very cross-disciplinary approach of people working together at common scales with common definitions to be able to integrate. And by common scales, I mean spatially and temporally. So once you are able to create it, you take a various level, like a geologic bedrock mapping, soils mapping, landform and surface water, climatological data, and you integrate it in layers. It gives you the tools then to create a map, derivative product maps of what the ecosystems look like at various scales and times. Crucial tool then, again, as we move forward into decision making. Finally, ecosystem services, a mechanism where we bring in economics, where we bring in decision support tools to say, what is the value of that watershed? New York State had a great example where they came out and New York City had a big problem with water. And they could create big reservoirs. They said, wait a second, why don't we spend some money, invest, and protect our watersheds? Because they did that, they went out and they bought up land, put watersheds in protective status. New York City has one of the best water systems in the world. They protected the natural core systems. So they understood the value of the ecosystem services that were being provided, and they invested in it, rather than investing simply in pipe or man-made dams or in water treatment plants. The goods and values that come from the natural system are many, both in terms of providing food, providing protection from disease, providing water, providing energy, providing basic human health. Right now, in economic discussions and societal decisions, these ecosystems are not getting full value. I'll just give you an example again, the part material that we struggled with, the Colorado River, big water source for the West. The Glen Canyon Dam sits on the upstream side of the Grand Canyon National Park. That dam provides much water for the area. It provides hydropower, which replaces only alternative for energy out there is coal besides the hydropower. But it restricts sediment. It restricts water. And the Grand Canyon, which used to flow as a very muddy water, now flows as a very clear, cold water river. And the sediment, much of the sediment that used to go down that river is impounded behind the dam. Big issue because, A, the river doesn't have the gravel bars for the rafting in the park. B, endangered species like the humpback chub were dependent on warmer temperatures and the back bar habitats created by the sandbars. Archaeological sites are eroding away because the sediment isn't coming in the natural processes. So a lot of work was done to say, can we temporarily release over periods of time large amounts of water, flush sand coming these distributary channels into the river? Can we manage the sand flow in the river to provide an improved habitat sufficient for endangered species and for the preservation of the qualities in the park? At the same time, can we honor the power needs, and can we deal with the treaty rights of the folks downstream on the river? Fascinating discussion. You can imagine each of those parties going after the other party. The park says, this is a national treasure. We need to put it back the way it was. We want the dam to go away. The power generation guys say, every time I release water into there, I lose millions of dollars of clean energy through the loss of energy. The Fish and Wildlife Service said, well, what about my humpback chub and my other species that are endangered? And, you know, how do we deal with those? That's the big priority. And how would you deal with invasive plants that are coming into the park? The downstream guys say, well, what about us? So inevitably, the way to evolve is to understand all those values and try to the best of your ability reach enlightened compromise to be able to maintain and manage those resources in a way that keeps a judge in a court from making those decisions. It takes a lot of science, but it also takes an understanding of the values of those ecosystem services equal to that of the power, equal to that to recreational values. So if we don't find ways to sufficiently value and integrate that into our discussions, we won't be able to do an apples-to-apples comparison. So ecosystem services are a growing approach in economics that hopefully is gaining more sophistication as we go. Markets to date are clearly inefficient in terms of conveying the value of the ecosystems. If you look at Western Water, the city of Las Vegas can afford to pay a whole lot more money for that water than can the agriculture users, than can the people that want to preserve the ecosystem. So again, putting true values on these things and the appropriate values becomes crucial if you're really going to solve these sorts of issues. So again, I told you I was going to depress you at first, but I want to give you some positive reinforcement that this can work. My view is that this integrated scientific approach can and will help us build bridges to rational solutions. Science, I don't think, will ever give us the definitive answer because of the value systems are so desperate, but they can limit the options to reasonable policy decision making. Hopefully, so reasoned compromise can be met and reasoned decisions can make rather than ideological bents on either the left or the right. So I see the science as necessary to confine the argument, not necessarily prescriptive on a single outcome, but provide policymakers with reasoned outcomes that have reasonable probability of success. So here's an example of one of the challenges, and in some ways one of the success stories. This is our Florida Everglades. A huge amount, billions of dollars have been spent in trying to restore the Everglades, working through the issues. The issues are many and challenged. Here you can see an invasive species Burmese python on the right. We think there's up to 40,000 Burmese pythons now in the Everglades. They're challenging the alligators to be the top predator in the Everglades, but they're an invasive species, largely released originally by people in Miami along the Tamiami Trail, which cuts through the Everglades. We have lots of invasive species. At the same time, the biggest issue is water in the Everglades. We have tremendous usage challenges for water. Everglades is basically a slow-moving river of water, which then supports a huge number of estuaries in the coastal area, which are habitat for a remarkable series of fish and birds. So the water must flow through the system. Much of the water has been diverted over time in the Everglades for agricultural uses and for an incredibly fast-growing population on both coasts and increasingly toward the middle of the southern Florida. So you have tremendous challenges and competition for water, you have invasive species, and you have a tremendous amount of unique and endangered species like the Florida panther that live in the Everglades. So how do we manage all that, preserve this World Heritage Site in an effective way? A lot of work has been done. You can see the original flow of the Everglades. You can see how it's been diverted and changed, largely by the Tamiami Trail that cut across the state, which acts as a big dam. Also from impoundment in agricultural areas and in flood protection and water usage in the Miami-Dade area on the right, and then a growing increasing amount of population growth on the west coast. So the goal here is you can look at the original system. You can see now how much the preserved natural system has shrunk. Can we release enough water in the manufactured system on the right to simulate the historical conditions? And right now work is going on in diverting the water. I will say several challenges exist here. The first of all is much of the water released is coming from agricultural areas, and they're high in sulfates from using. Well, sulfates mixes with mercury to create what's called methylmercury. It creates an oxidation. Methylmercury then is the type of mercury that gets ingested by animals. So by moving water high in sulfates down, all of a sudden we're creating a bunch of active mercury into the system, which the birds and the fish and the alligators are extremely vulnerable to. So just moving the water is not enough. We have to make sure the water is clean enough of high quality and we're not creating other problems by trying to recreate a natural system in a highly altered system. So working through how do we manage mercury deposition is a huge issue with moving the water. It's not simple enough to move it. Secondly, the issue of climate change. The Everglades, if we have a 1 meter rise in sea level, 60% of the Everglades is underwater. The bays in the Florida area, you can see are those estuaries, those brackish water areas, the habitat for the fish and the mangroves are dependent on that fresh water coming into the system. If we flood back, those bays go hypersaline very quickly, and they lose their capacity as estuaries. So have we acknowledged or understand the naturally and anthropogenically occurring sea level rise that's occurring in the Everglades and adjusted our management plan to it? The answer is no, we're working on it. But to do that, good science is occurring in drilling cores to understand the historical record for the last 15,000 years of when those bays have gone hypersaline, when they haven't, prior to major anthropogenic effects. So if we understand the natural systems, we'll have a lot better understanding of our ability to manage as we see sea level rise and other issues. And in fact, we have to acknowledge that managing these systems that are highly vulnerable to climate change will be an art, will be an adaptive art, that we're going to have to understand that we're not going to get it right the first time. We're going to make incremental stages for improvement. But this is a remarkable effort in the Everglades, a huge amount of cooperation with the state of Florida, the South Miami Water District, the Fish and Wildlife Service, the USGS, the Park Service, and then the state of Florida, environmental organizations, as well as the state of Florida government to really bring forth the best quality restoration that we can. So this is a pretty neat story. It's a very positive outcome to date, but a work in progress. This is the Famine Early Warning Network, created in about the year 2000. USGS, NASA, USAID, NOAA got together to say, what can we do to predict the changes that are going to lead to food shortages in mid and southern Africa? If we can do that, then we can get the relief supplies there ahead of time. that we can mitigate the disaster before it gets critical. So a tremendous amount of in-situ space observational data is being provided, in-situ ground monitoring, ecosystem management, and then physical observation of the plant cycle and the seasonal change to be able to predict and when we're going to hit periods of crisis to be able to get the food there ahead of time. This has been a remarkable success story. Just not to leave geology out, this is some work that we did in Afghanistan. One of the big issues in Afghanistan, of course, is there is not a stable economy. You can do all you want with respect to military security. If people can't get jobs, they can't get food, they can't get energy, they can't get water, it doesn't matter. So we were funded, the USGS largely funded through the country of Afghanistan, USAID, DOD, to do some work to identify resources for the country and hazards for the country. Of course, it's very dangerous to do work on the foot, on your foot there. You get shot at a lot, and you can't get access to many areas of the country. So we put together an integrated survey, aerial-borne survey, to look at oil and gas, mineral resources, coal resources, water resources, earthquake hazards, and then also urban development. And we put together a pretty neat package of working together with the Afghani government. We also spent a lot of time training Afghan science, retraining, reinventing Afghan scientists, bringing them over to our country, training them in situ in Kabul to be able to monitor and manage their systems themselves. But we put together an integrated package to look at a lot of different data in a single aircraft that could fly high enough to deal with the mountains and surface air missiles at the same time. In that, we flew a hyperspectral survey. We flew radar. We flew magnetic and gravity data and a high-quality digital suite. So we had this amazing suite of devices. Just to give you some examples, the high-resolution photography helped us identify resources on the surface. It also helped us in urban planning, radar, all-weather, greater penetration into the ground, hyperspectral, wonderful data set. We can identify individual minerals, individual plants, a tremendous prospecting tool. So wide ranges beyond optical on both sides. Finally, magnetic and gravity data down to 30 kilometers. So here in a single sweep, we go from the surface down to 30 kilometers, integrated information that identified geologic faults, identified water resources, identified coal, identified a significant amount of energy resources, including oil and gas, helped us understand the fault patterns, the geologic fault patterns and risk, and helped them with urban development and people planning, all in one survey. Wonderful success story. Only wish we could borrow the airplane and bring it over to the United States and fly our country with it. But it's a great example of taking technology, taking integrated science, and really developing value. Afghan president and the Minister of Mines and Energy, rather, were extremely grateful. And this gives them, the good news is Afghanistan has tremendous resource base to build on, to build the nation build on, if they're wise in the way they do that. So hopefully, in the near future, we'll see something besides poppies being grown there. So I just want to show you three different examples where science and technology can be brought in a policy-relevant way to help deal with some of these huge issues. It'll be the challenge for looking at whole systems approach to reveal and recognize the nature of our Earth's system of systems. We have to accept and understand the risks and the mitigation and adaptation strategies for climate and population growth, if we're going to deal with effectively. It involves all of us at all scales, locally, nationally, and internationally. We live in an interconnected world to scale, of these issues. And again, we all have a lot at stake at this. So I'm hoping we have some scientists in this room that 20 or 30 years from now will bring us the answers. We are working to develop the framework. We're working together. We're making some incredible discoveries. We're learning how to integrate and talk between our scientific disciplines, and we're improving, but we have a long ways to go. With that, I think I'll close, again, in my mind, on a very optimistic note that wonderful opportunities. So I guess we have time for questions.
Is this on? Okay. What's your prognosis on the political will to do some of this? That's ultimately where it's going to land in.
Well, it's certainly very difficult because I was trying to point out the problems are multi-decadal in terms of developing coherent solutions, replacing energy supplies, building continuity, maintaining ecosystems, adapting to the change we're seeing, and managing the way we even build our cities and our transportation systems. So is there a political will? It's a good question in my mind. I will say the problems are being identified by the current president. Can he convert the political rhetoric into action is the question in a four-year political cycle. That's an unknown to me. Again, hopefully, if we can get the information out, if we have really true leadership, Abraham Lincoln-type leadership, I'm optimistic. At the same time, the immense pressures, you can see a stimulus package going to a jobs bill really quickly versus the long-term investment. So how do you balance the short-term needs versus the long-term without eating your seed corn in an economic recession? It's a huge issue to me. Again, as a scientist, I don't have to answer that question. I'll leave it to our political scientists. But if we can get the information out there, if the American people can understand what's at stake, I'm more optimistic. But it is difficult in our political environment where you've got 2 years to develop your administration and 2 years to dismantle it, that we can really do this. But I hope so. We need to.
Yeah. Mark, in your comments you had noted how science for looking at these complex environmental change problems is becoming much more of a partnership kind of an approach, and that USGS is partnering with lots of institutions in a variety of programs. I was interested, though, that all the examples that you gave of the kinds of institutions that USGS has partnered with, they were all scientific institutions. And one of the things that's becoming more common, maybe related to some of the decision support stuff that you mentioned, is doing science in partnership, not with scientific institutions, but with the public organizations, science assessments such as like the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment, U.S. National Assessment of Climate Change, Ozone Assessment. Has the USGS, do they have active programs of that kind of participatory assessment and science? And at lunch today, you were talking a little bit about your concern about sort of keeping science somehow protected from political pressures. And so if you could comment on, in those more participatory assessment processes, how do you do good science and also serve public needs?
Yeah, it's very difficult to provide the objectivity of the science necessary and to keep it out of the advocacy range to deal with complex issues and conflict unless you can guarantee the sanctity of the objectivity of the process through peer review and through sheltering those scientists from the political process. At the same time, the GS has been involved with the CCSP, the Climate Change Program. We're an integral member. I was one of the principals for it. We were involved with the Millennial Assessment, so we're engaged. We also have asked us to engage our economists and our geographers that look at social issues, not just political issues, into the mix. Give you an example is we just really, USGS spearheaded a five million person earthquake exercise called the Great Shakeout in Southern California. We developed a simulation model for a likely large-scale earthquake on the San Andreas in Los Angeles, and through the sheer tenacity of a couple of our scientists, Lucy Jones in particular, woman who's on the Seismic Commission, PhD, Caltech person, came, and she had such a passion for getting people involved. She just wouldn't let go. Pretty soon, we had the state of California engaged, we had the universities engaged, and we had a 5 million person exercise and at schools. We had the Secretary of Interior there. We had Arnold Schwarzenegger engaged. We had mass evacuation drills. We had public utilities that never worked together talking to each other about, well, if I release the water from my dam to protect the structure, if we all do it at the same time, where's the water going to come from? How do we shut down the electric grid? How do we deal with mass fires? How do we deal with sheltering millions of people in place? And what happens if the aqueducts collapse? We may have to shelter people for months without water supplies. So all these discussions went on because of the tenacity of folks in the scientific community that went outside the box and engaged it. They kept the science to the peer review process, but they then took the next stage of engaging it. Our geographers looked at the entire infrastructure with a lot of help from universities and the city of Los Angeles to value it and say, and gave them decision support tools that said, if you want to mitigate the effects, where do you spend your money? If you spend your money on this bridge, here's what you might save. This is a critical infrastructure. This might save. If you do your subway system, this is where to do it. So economic cost-benefit analysis is mitigation, probabilistically based, to give them tools to go back and get the funding to manage that process of mitigation. All were built into the structure. And then people practiced it, and individuals took responsibility. Our scientists said, if you want to do one, just do one thing. After this drill, after you've exercised, do one thing in your home. Tighten down your water heater. Get a fire extinguisher. Individual actions will really make the difference. So that next level of engagement kept the science pure, but worked through decision support tools, economic evaluation, and then led to the agencies that have the regulatory actions. To me, that's the perfect way, because in that exercise, there were people that tried to poke holes at the science, saying, oh, this isn't real, this isn't legitimate, and it didn't work, because that scientific base was so well done and so independently done. We weren't trying to sell anybody anything, and it really what it came down to. And through that process, again, you can see that replayed with ecosystem services, if you can do it. So I do believe in seeing the conflict that if you regulate or own the resource, you end up having difficulty with maintaining objectivity. And if you are objective, people that have a different point of view aren't going to accept it. So refereed science, to me, in these critical issues is absolutely important. Authoritative information versus spun information is critical if people are going to rely on it. So I don't see any other way but to do that. On the other hand, the next level of communication then of the science into decision support tools to me is a necessary step, and it has to involve economic and social values. The GS strategy that you saw is based on one fundamental premise. The science needs to serve society. Each one of those issues is an area of major societal benefit. A lot of us are curious about those areas. We spend our lives studying those areas as scientists. But if the argument we made of the science strategy, if you can't show its scientific societal relevance, you shouldn't be doing it in the USGS. You need to do that in a different arena.
You show up on slide that show different aspects of science and geology that the USGS was studying. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, given the problems facing us with increased population, lack of resources, global warming, what disciplines of geology do you think will be in the highest demand in the future?
Boy, a lot of different ones. Clearly, energy, particularly alternative energies, hazards resiliency, work, so understanding earthquakes, volcano, landslides, fire, other issues, the ecological effects. What we found is a way to study it, and if you look at the hazards, it was really an approach on multiple hazards, that often if you have a fire, the area is now susceptible to landslides. So understanding that geological context isn't just a fire science issue, it's a slope stability issue. It's a groundwater issue. It's a water contaminant issue after the fire. The water coming down now is turbid and contaminant, and often contains contaminants. So understanding, again, water quality, landslides, hazards, energy resources, water resources, again, that integration between surface and groundwater and water and ecology versus the traditional management of water strictly for human consumption or non-consumptive uses. The scientist that can integrate sparse pieces of data into coherent packages. One of the things that I valued most as a geologist is you never have enough information. You're always looking at this four-dimensional puzzle, as a geologist, the fourth being time, the three being the other three dimensions, with limited information. So a geologist that can stretch and reach across with limited pieces of that Rubik's Cube and put it together is going to be the most valuable geologist. Obviously, IT skill sets are going to be necessary to manage the data sets. Not IT experts, but the ability to do effective GIS work are also real critical tools. So I almost think any area of geology is relevant if applied. The one other area in climate change I think is going to be increasing demand is paleoclimatology, paleoecology. That's because we have a huge challenge with what is shorter-term effects, environmental effects, versus what is long-term. So the only way to get to the real long-term signal is to get back in the geologic record, whether it's tree rings, whether it's ice cores, whether it's pack rat middens, to look at that, whether it's the soil or the rock record. Incredible amount of information there to look at the long-term climatic effects. Work we've done and others have done in, again, along the Colorado River has shown that when we allocated waters in the 30s, it was one of the wettest periods in the last 500 years. And we wouldn't have known that if we didn't have the historical geologic record to look at that basin. It means that the climate effects we're seeing, the decrease in water, could well be the norm, and we managed allocated water in a period of great abundance. That spells that your high probability of having water shortages in the West are going to increase. So that paleoecological work, paleoclimatic work, is a huge area where geologists have to make contributions. And then finally, basic monitoring data. We have sparse capacity and long-term records necessary on water flow, and in other ecological areas where geologists work to be able to link back to see again what is short term, what is longer term. Lots of different areas.
You discussed how good science should be passed to decision makers. Do you have any thoughts about how the United States can pursue policies to educate the American people more about these issues? I can remember 6 years ago, 7 years ago, global warming was dismissed by many people as simply, just a bias. And I think that's gone now, but it still seems to me that the really huge obstacle to confront these challenges is, frankly, the basic ignorance of American people about science. Have you thought much about that issue?
Actually, a lot. I think it starts with most people care about what's in their backyard. We live in an urban society. Our kids are no longer out there experiencing the outdoors. Milk comes from a refrigerator or store. Water comes from a tap. We're not relating back to the natural systems because we live in an urban environment. So there's a disconnect, the fundamental disconnect between cause and effect. And if you live in a city, you're not necessarily noticing these things, right? You don't notice that your water's still coming to you in the tap. The bus is still coming to your street. It may be a little more smoggy, but you're not seeing the effects because it's not immediate in your backyard. So understanding the relationship we have to our natural environment would be the first thing. We have to educate our kids. We've got to get kids outside. Scientists need to take time off being scientists and becoming educators. Get those kids in the grade school out there. Show them the relationship. And that can be done in the backyard creek as well as can be done in a national park. So we lack the national will right now to get the relationship back to nature to the extent to understand the natural systems. Again, and as we become more and more urbanized, it's been a tendency. When we were an agrarian society, there was a much closer relationship to that landmass. So fundamentally, education, getting folks out there at the first level, showing why it's important to their backyard. I mean, it amazes me, and thank goodness I have a pitcher of water here, but most people will give you water in a plastic bottle from the tap, transported by truck with a lot of energy in a plastic bottle, the same water you get out of your tap. You know, we're not educated enough to even recognize that is a terrible waste of resources. So getting some sense of understanding of the linkages, understanding personal responsibility, and then, as you said, a basic science education. Scientists have to also, we live in a society that wants to know, and I love the term, in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, where the answer, the life, the universe, and everything is the number 42. But that's what we want. We want a simple, universal answer. Science is muddy. Science is always improving on uncertainty, or if it's doing its job, but it's never providing certainty. Confuses people, irritates policymakers. I guarantee you it irritates many congressmen. I can say that personally. But the fact is we have to be able to manage folks to understand that process.
Is it worth it in Alaska to drill? And if it is, how can we preserve the life and protect the life of the wild animals? Because Miss Cruella, Sarah Palin, she doesn't care of the animals at all. And secondly, it's a statement. I come from Europe, and maybe here in America, people could save one-fifth or one-sixth of the energy they use of living unhealthy. When the wind was always cold, the heat is on 90 degrees, there's no fresh air and no oxygen, they have headache and take pills. And if you get air comes in, it warms much faster than these dirt particles in the air. But it is so difficult, and how we can change the lifestyles of Americans, of most of them. Thank you.
Great. I detected three or four questions there. So let me start with an appreciation for the need for conservation. It wasn't in my slides. We need to be better at conserving. We need to recognize efficiencies. And in a lot of ways, my colleague Susan Wachter at Wharton talks about redesigning cities. One of the first things we do is Europeans had less landmass and bigger populations and longer established cities, your city centers are built much more efficiently than ours in general. So we have built a societal structure based on cheap energy, cheap land, and free water. And those assumptions, again, as we've seen in the last couple of decades, none of those are true anymore. So fundamentally, we have to, I believe, re-engineer our urban environments, urban sprawl. You know, we have to be more, I'd say, more European in terms of design. So that's the first thing, I think. But that's a monumental change. That's a huge investment that's going to have to happen over time. Clearly more mass transit in the conservation stages, more efficient use of water, more deliberate decision-making on how we use the resources are clearly part of this. With the Alaska part, a lot of different issues in that question, and I won't do the Sarah Palin thing, but I will say in Alaska there is very few people and lots of land, and conversely almost no economy outside of resource extraction for people to live. So people in Alaska generally have a different view because they don't have a diversified economy and they're dependent on those resources. The state revenues to run government are coming out of those resources. So fundamentally, you have a different set of drivers than you have in an economy like Pennsylvania that's highly diversified. You also lack basic infrastructure. There are no roads connecting most of the native villages. You have to fly by air. They are dependent on diesel fuel. There's no good energy source for them. And you have a lot of environmental problems with those villages because they're situated in places that are on coastal areas going through erosion and lots of other challenges. So the basic infrastructure you take for granted here is only there in the larger cities. So you're taking something that is more of a snapshot back a bunch of years in the United States, probably closest prior to rural electrification of this country in many cases. So those are some of the basic challenges Alaska faces. Long ways from infrastructure, high cost energy, cold, difficult environment to live in, but a beautiful environment, and very low population density to land mass. So the question then becomes, how does Alaska develop an economy at the same time deal with environmental sustainability? And those decisions, like they have been down here, are going to generally be compromised decisions. So the question isn't whether you do energy development or not, is that do you put in very tough environmental restrictions? Do you limit the areas? Drilling in Anwar may not be the same as drilling in Cook Inlet, or drilling in Prudhoe Bay is going to be different than drilling in NPRA, than drilling in the Chukchi Sea. So intelligent decisions have to be made about where to drill, what the value of the prize is, and what the environmental consequences are. So it's a very complex series of issues. But from an Alaskan perspective, the Alaskan issues, I've learned, I saw this in the political campaign, don't translate to the viewpoint in the rest of the country. It's a very different mindset. It's a very different set of economic and environmental issues that they face. Are you talking about in the state, or are you talking about in Anwar, or because there's clearly undiscovered oil potential. I think you saw on the map those red circles. If you looked in Alaska, there were red and green circles. It's one of the largest remaining sources of oil, and particularly natural gas, in the country, quite clearly in the Alaska and the offshore. The challenges will be, what are the policies? And what, if they are developed, what are the environmental safeguards? It's a very, very difficult, politically charged issue. Again, USGS's job in there was not to advocate an outcome, but to tell people what the likely resource bases are using the best technology and the best common methodology on the oil and gas and other energy side. But it's also to say that same thing on the biological side, so people can compare values and make those decisions. They're going to be tough decisions. If you don't get your energy from Alaska, are you willing to get into Montana or Wyoming or drill shale gas wells in high density in Pennsylvania? I mean, those are the kinds of trade-offs that need to be discussed in national policy. At the same time, because simply, as you saw from the chart, or are you willing to forego the natural gas in Alaska and say we're going to increase the coal as on that chart? So these are all trade-offs. Some are more global. Some are more related to global warming. Some are more basic environmental preservation of certain environments. But they need to be made in a holistic policy way with those trade-offs understood and always, always with tough regulations in place. But it's a great challenge. The biggest challenge I think we face on many of the energy issues, even with alternatives, is it's nice if it's in the other guy's backyard, but when that wind turbine or that power line goes through my lot, I don't like it so much. So we have to, as a society, figure out how to deal with not in my backyard, and I'm going to bear the burden of the cost that someone else benefits from. So these are all big political, social, and economic issues that come along with trying to figure out the energy pie. And quite honestly, those are some of the reasons I put that long discussion of the energy sources and the realities of the difficulties of just saying I'm going to turn over to green energy. At the scale necessary, it's going to take decades. And in the meantime, we're going to have to bridge it with some fuel. And if it's not natural gas, say, from Alaska, just what is it going to be? Is it going to be nuclear on a massive scale? Is it going to be more coal? I mean, those are the two likely contenders. Is it going to be imported LNG? Those are the kinds of hard choices that the reality of the situation requires. And so we'll see what the new administration decides. A lot of this is in the power of the Secretary of the Interior. Because much of the land in Alaska, I think nearly 70% of the land, is federally owned. The biggest chunk of that by the Department of Interior. So stay tuned. I can't give you the answer of your question. I think the policymakers will. What would I do? I would get as much natural gas out of Alaska, as much natural gas as I could out of the Gulf of Mexico, as I could to try to get a bridge fuel going, to buy time to get to longer-term solutions of, I don't know if it's nuclear, I don't know if it's a combination of geothermal, nuclear, solar, but whatever we need in the right mix. We simply have to make a tough choice now if you're going to mitigate greenhouse gases. And the only bridge fuel I see out there that's ready with an existing infrastructure is natural gas. So if you ask me, I would drill for natural gas in Alaska, and I would build a pipeline from Alaska. I would really look at gas hydrates worldwide, try to find a big source again, of natural gas to bridge the next 30 or 40 years while we build the electrical grid, the technology, the storage battery capacity, the geothermal capacity, and the wind capacity in this country. It's going to take us time.
On behalf of Dickinson College and the Clark Forum, I would like to thank our speaker, Mark Myers. This concludes tonight's program. Thank you for coming and have a good evening.